Gilgamesh chapter 14. Gilgamesh chapter 14. Now, we're back again to the two kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah. In the northern kingdom of Israel, we are dealing with Yerosh, and it's the end of his reign, really. We came back again because he was interested in saving Israel from utter destruction by Aram, by Syria. His success, he restores a certain amount of normalcy into the kingdom, and his successor is Jeroboam, his son. In the meantime, we are going to direct our attention also to the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom is to us the more important of the two for several reasons. The one reason is that its kings all belong to the Davidic dynasty. The second reason is its capital is Jerusalem, with the base of Midrash, and it is the Torah center of both the northern and the southern kingdom. We are now back again to the southern kingdom, and it tells us that Bishnash time the Yerosh ben Yerochos Melech Israel, in the second year of Yerosh, the son of Yerochos, the king of Israel. Come on. If they aren't seats, tomorrow you're sitting. Reasonably comfortable. Are you sitting?
Right here.
Everybody see? All that. Now, in the second year of Yerosh, the son of Yerochos, the king of Israel, Molech Amatziohu ben Yerosh, the king of Judah. Now, let us, for the moment, go back to the kingdom of Judah, to the southern kingdom. You will remember that we left, last time we left the southern kingdom, it was with the death of King Yerosh. He is the king that began to reign when he was 7 years old. He is the king whose whole life was a miracle, because the queen of Talyahu was killing out any pretender to the throne. And it was his aunt and his uncle who smuggled him away into the base of Midrash, where his uncle Yehoyadah was the Kohen Gadol, and they kept him there for 6.5 years, almost 7 years. And only when he was 7 years old did they make it known that he had been saved and that he was king, and then he was crowned king, and that Talyahu was killed. He was a very fine king, guided entirely by Yehoyadah, his uncle, and who was the Kohen Gadol. As soon as Yehoyadah died, then the trouble began. The people made him out to be someone who was gifted with quite extraordinary powers, powers that were almost divine. It went to his head to such an extent that he now did things that were against the Torah, and when he was reprimanded and admonished by the prophet Zechariah, who was the son of Yehoyadah, the man who, together with his wife, saved him as a babe, and the man who guided him and was his teacher, when this man died and his son admonished the king, Zechariah, the king had him put to death. Do you remember who were the ones who put him to death?
Moabites.
Very good. A Moabite and an Ammonite. That is, one was descended from the Moabites, and one was descended from the Ammonites. And the reason we are told by Chazal is because he was a kofri tovo, to take the son of the man who saved you, the son of the woman who saved you your whole life, the son of the man who taught you, who directed you, and you put him to death. And why do you put him to death? Because he's doing his duty, and he's doing his duty for your benefit. He's admonishing you for your benefit. And he comes in the name of Hashem and as a prophet, and you put him to death. Now that is something that is inexcusable. And the person who eventually puts him to death, the people who put him to death are descendants of Ammonites and Moabites that are the descendants of Lot. They are known for their ingratitude, because Abraham was the one who did for Lot that so many hundred years later Yehoyadah and his wife did for Yoash. Abraham saved Lot, and when he was captured, he went out with a small army to fight for him and to bring him back. So their father was saved by Abraham, and when Abraham's children were going through the desert and it was a question of bringing them water, they refused to do it. Small thing. Refuse to bring them water. That is ingratitude. So the ones that are chosen by Hashem to put Yoash to death, and he was assassinated, was a descendant of an Ammonite and a descendant of a Moabite. And Zachar Yohu was the prophet whom they put to death. Now that is something that we've got to remember, because it is going to come up again, but it will still take some time before it comes up. There we left the southern kingdom, and now it's Yoash that is dead, and his successor is Amatsyahu, his son. In verse 2 he tells us, Ben Esri Mechomesho Noho Yorbim Olcho, he was 25 years old when he began to reign. The Esri Mosesho Shona Molach Birushalayim, he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. V'shem Imo Yehoadon Min Yerushalayim, the name of his mother was Yehoadon of Jerusalem. Those first two verses, we are introduced now to the position as it is in Yerushalayim. And from there we take it further in verse 3. And it tells us, Vayasa Yoshua Bnei Hashem, and he did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord. Rak lo kedavid ovid, only not as his father David. Kechol asher oso Yoash ovid oso, he did according to all that Yoash his father did. This is a point here, there is a point here on which I would like to dwell for a little while. He tells us he did right in the eyes of Hashem, and then it modifies it and it qualifies it. Rak Lotus Yovid Ovid, but not as his father Dovid, it means his ancestor, but not as his ancestor Dovid. Kechol asher oso Yoash Ovid oso, he did according to all that his father Yoash did. You will remember that the first part of Yoash's reign was a very good one and a very successful one, as long as the high the Kohen Gadol lived, Yehoyadah, who was his mentor. That was an excellent reign. And what Yoash did was to repair the breaches in the Beis HaMikdash, to restore the service of the Beis HaMikdash. He was able to do all that. That is the good that he did. Amatsyahu, his son, comes along and follows in the footsteps of his father. The Beis HaMikdash is sacred to him, and he has every reason to regard the Beis HaMikdash as sacred to him. The Beis HaMikdash really saved his life. It was only because of the Beis HaMikdash that his father was enabled to live. So Amatsyahu realizes that he does according to all that his father did, but not according to that which David HaMelech did. Now, right?
But the thing is that he would be even better because he doesn't have a mentor as his father did. So, you know, he's not even though his father only did while the mentor was alive, so it wasn't really...
It's better to do good with the mentor than without the mentor.
But then wouldn't that make him even better, the son, even better than the father?
No, because it may be good to have a mentor. A man that hasn't got a mentor may be better. But the man who seeks to have a mentor, puts himself under a mentor, is the best.
Yes, right?
That is the way it is. Everybody seeks. Everybody who seeks to have somebody just better than himself, to whom he can go and with whom he can discuss some things, everybody tries to get that sort of person. And if he hasn't got it, it says in Pirkei Avos, "Asei lechodav," make for yourself. Just you've got to have somebody better than yourself that you can go to and ask and discuss something. Now, what is this? Does that his father does, but it's not as his ancestor David. There is one amongst the very many great qualities of David HaMelech, there is one that comes out in his Psalms. There is a term that is used, I'm not going to put it on the board, because it doesn't matter if you don't remember the Hebrew phrase, Nitzkas Anoshim Melumodo, and that is doing something mechanically. One does the mitzvahs, but one does it mechanically. The other way, of course, to do it is to do it out of love, out of great love to Hashem, and consequently to do it with kavanah, that is, being conscious of what it is one is doing. It is on the moral level, it is doing the right thing, but simultaneously doing the right thing for the right reasons. And when you have these two qualifications regulating everything one does, then you can be quite sure there will be Siyata Dishmaya, there will be help from heaven. That one does it the right thing for the right reason. That there is a taharo, there is a purity about it. A Amatzion becomes king. David had this great quality. In all his actions, he did the right thing, and he did it always for the right reason. When he cut off the corner of the coat of Saul, he does it in order to prove to Saul that he has no evil in him. His whole life is on that principle. He does the right thing and he's conscious always of the reason he does it. Here we have a person like a Matsyahu. I don't want you to do that, you see. But also housekeeping to do that. It's sit down there.
We have two people.
Oh, I see. All right. We have no chasing that, of course, Doctor. We don't have to be chasing anything.
Yes,
But we need a chair there in any of them. The right thing, but there is no reasoning behind it. He does it out. It's a mechanical action. He does what his father did. And there's always left over this little bit of wrong. And that is that when the people before the Beis HaMikdash was built in the time of Shlomo HaMelech people had their own private altars on which they sacrificed and they burnt incense. And the law was, once the Beis HaMikdash was built, that was prohibited. That they continued to have, and there they continued on their own private worship. That he didn't do away with. And we discussed that how difficult it was for a king to do away with something like this. This was so ingrained in the people. And it was that when the kingdom was strong in his hand, you remember that Yo'osh the king, yes, alright, let them bring it in a minute. I don't want double. What he does is the Ammonite and the Moabite, who killed his father, who were responsible for the assassination of his father, Yo'osh. So now when his kingdom was strong in his hand, that is when he had consolidated his kingdom and established it, by Yachis Abodoba Makimis Amelechovi, then he killed those officers who had killed his father. The Esbenea Makim Lohemis, and he didn't kill the sons of those who smote his father. After all, they smote his father, and he, the son, smites them. There is now the possibility that as he took up the cudgels for the honor of his father, they, the sons of the Ammonite and the Moabite, would take up cudgels for the honor of their father, so the same thing is to kill them also. Well, he didn't do it. Well, he exercised reason, and he wanted to do the right thing for the right reason, that he had the right to do, but that he was not prepared to go as far as that. And he says why. But he did not put to death the sons of the assassins, as it is written in the law, in the book of the law of Moshe, that is in Devarim, Asher Tzivu Hashem Lemor, how Hashem commanded, saying, Lo yumsu obos arbonim uvonim lo yumsu al obos. Father shall not be put to death for children, and children shall not be put to death for fathers. He in ish bechet o yumos, but each man shall be put to death for his own sin. So therefore, because of that principle, he's not prepared to do it. It would have been advantageous for him to do it. Can you imagine the harm that the sons of these people are going to do to him? But the correct thing is not to go as far as their children, and he doesn't do it because that is the correct thing to do. That is the law. You might have noticed a slip of the tongue on my part when I translated Gel Yusu Obus Arbonim. My correction was, father shall not die for the children, that is for the sins of the children, and I said by a slip of the tongue, fathers shall not die by children, you remember. And they are according to the Din, a child cannot give evidence against a father, and a father cannot give evidence against a child. Sons cannot give evidence against a father that the father committed the murder, nor can the father give evidence against the son. That is the one meaning of it. And the second meaning is the one when I corrected myself, for that father shall not die for the sins of children, nor children for the sins of the fathers. He in ish v'chet el yumos, for the benefit of those who know Hebrew, because a man, each man shall die for his own sin. There is a kri and a kasiv. It is read yumos, which means will be put to death. It is written yomus, which means will die. And what it means is that each man shall die for his own sin. If he commits a sin for which the penalty is capital, is death, then the Beit Din, the Sanhedrin, will carry out that punishment if he's found guilty. If they cannot carry out that punishment because of insufficient evidence, or because there wasn't any warning, but nevertheless he is guilty, he will still die, but then he dies as a judgment by Hashem and not as a result of a judgment by Sanhedrin. And that is why it's written Yomus, it's written Yomus, and it's read Yomos. There are two interpretations of it, and when we read this, we must be aware of both interpretations. Is that all right? And you've got the way it's written is Yud Mem Vov Tov, and it's Yomus. But it's pronounced Yomos as if the Vov was taken out. That, and there should be a note in the margin. There should be a note in the margin as the Vov comes between the Yud and the Mem in the way it is read, and not between the Mem and the Vov in the way it is written. Now that is what we call Korean Kasir, and of course the secularists go and they say that this was a mistake and it was afterwards corrected, and this is something which is absolutely wrong. There's a reason for it, and that is the Masorah. And you probably, some of you know quite a lot about biblical criticism and the higher biblical criticism that started over 150 years ago in Germany. There was biblical criticism before that, but the higher biblical criticism 150 years ago in Germany. And anyway, it was cut up, the whole of the Torah was cut up. And the book of Isaiah was divided into two parts, and the one part was put as late, hundreds of years afterwards, and then they cut it up into three parts, and eventually they cut it up into four parts. And I think it was 1947. When was the State of Israel declared? 1948. In 1947, they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, and amongst the scrolls that they were discovered was an almost complete book of Isaiah. If it's not complete, it is only because in unfolding it, part of it stuck, the parchment stuck together, and they weren't able to do it with it, but afterwards they were able to put it together. And lo and behold, it is one complete work. Not only is it one complete work, but it is exactly the same as we've got it today. The same spelling, written exactly the same way as we've got it today. And that, of course, was a very great event. Now, where do you want to ask a question? I didn't give you the opportunity at the time.
Maybe there was also an issue that he couldn't slay the children of the Moabite and Ammonite that killed him, his father, because they didn't kill his father's child, it was himself. So if he were to kill their children, he would be grieved, and he would be doing
himself,
because he would be doing something that was not done against him.
And there's no question about that. There's no question that he does it. The deen is that he mustn't do it, although it would have been advantageous for himself. But he knows the deen is that he's not allowed to do that, and he refrains from doing that, which is a point very much in his favor. And now comes another part here, and this part can only be understood in conjunction. And this part can only be understood in conjunction with Divrei Hayomim, with the Book of Chronicles, which in very many instances supplements the books of Kings. If you start, let us start from verse 7. Who he call es et gaum, the Jay Hamela, or the Gay Mela. He smote Edom in the valley of the Sod, obviously very near the Dead Sea, where the land is very level And Edom, the land of Edom, is across the Dead Sea, on the other side of the Dead Sea, somewhat to the southeast. Then it says in verse 8, then sent amongst your messengers, verse 7, he smote Edom in the valley of Salt, Aselus Anophim, 10,000 men. The Sophas es Hasela Babilchomo, and he took the rock in warfare. The rock is the bastion, the fort, which was built on a rock. Vayikro es Shemor Yoxeel Ada Yom Hazeh, and he called its name Yoxeel unto this day. Ol Sholach Amatio Malachim El Yahuosh Ben Yahuachos Ben Yehu Melech Israel. Then Amatio, the king of the south of Judah, sends messengers to Yahuosh, the son of Yahuachos, the son of Yehu, the king of Israel, Leimor say, Lecho Nisro Eponi, come, let us face one another in war. That is what the words Nisro Eponim means. Let us face one another in warfare. Literally, let us see one another face to face. I will explain to you a little bit later what causes this, why he challenges the king of Israel to war. Yehoash replies to him, and this is what he says, by Hishlach Yehoash, Melech Yisrael. And Yehoash, the king of Israel, sent El Amatio Melech Yehudo to Amatio, the king of Judah, Lemo, saying, Achuach Asher Barbono, the thorn that is in Lebanon. Now, the king of the north is Yehoash, calls the king of the south, Amatio, the thorn that is in Lebanon. Sholach el ho erez asher balavonel, sends to the cedar that is in Lebanon. That is myself, Yahush. That is the way he describes this message that he receives. Leimor saying, Teno es bitachon ivni isho, give your daughter to my son as a wife. That is what the thorn says to the cedar. Vatavor chayas asodeh, and the beasts of the field pass by, asher balvona that are in the corner, vatirmus es achua, and they tread down and destroy the thorn. What kind of a mashal is this? What kind of an illustration is this? The illustration goes back to many hundreds of years. When Yaakov's daughter Dinah once went for a walk, and Shechem, Hamor ben Shechem, seduced her, and then went back to tell his father about it all, and they wanted Yaakov to give his daughter as a wife to the person who seduced him. You remember the story? And you remember what the sons of Yaakov did? They said, well, if you all become, you become circumcised, then, and they said, and the Shechemites said, look here, this is a wonderful idea. They will marry, and then your children will marry ours, and ours will marry yours, and we'll do business together, and we'll live together. And the results of the sons of Yaakov was, yes, but you've got to be circumcised. They circumcised themselves, and on the third day, they came and they killed them all out. Terrible thing. The sons of Jacob. Now, that is what Yehosh says to Amatio. He says, you, Amatio, are the thorn. You are Shechem. I, Yehosh, am Yaakov. I am the seed. You send me a message Same thing as Shechem did to Ya'akel. Now, what was the result? The beast of the field came. You remember that Yehuda is compared to the lion, that Binyamin is compared to the wolf, Yisrochel is compared to the chamel, to the ass, to the beast of burden. The beasts of the field come, the sons of Jacob come, and they destroy the thorn. So says Yoash to Amatsyoh, you want to go to war with me? You must know what the result is going to be. I shall annihilate you. That is what he says. Now, before we go any further, I want to explain to you, and I'm taking the opportunity to do so, because a very strong principle is involved here. And that is, why did they really do this, the sons of Jacob? They deceived them. They said, you must circumcise yourselves, and when they circumcised themselves on the third day, which is the worst day, they come and they kill them all out. Why did they do this? Any suggestions? Yes, Mary.
Well, did Yaakov's sons know that their intentions were dishonorable? And they were just trying to be one up on them?
Well, are you asking me or are you giving an answer?
I'm giving an answer to the question for.
Well, what justification is there for? Yes?
Well, the justification was... Taking
the earth. Well, but they all be killed. So kill only the one who did it.
But it was a conspiracy. There was a conspiracy in amongst them that they were going to take advantage. It was not a conversion. It wasn't. They were just going to take advantage of their position with Yaakov.
Well, almost right. That there is one basic thing that is missing. And this is something that I cannot stress sufficiently. There is Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz is not only something for the Jew, that belongs to every human being. The Torah was given for the Jew only. Derech Eretz is for every single human being. Derech Eretz is so strong, and I've told you this over and over again, that the prerequisite for the study of the Torah, and it's a prerequisite that it's a sine qua non, there must be Derech Eretz before the Torah. If there's no Derech Eretz, there can be no Torah. You will remember when Abimelech, when Abraham had to leave Eretz Israel, there was a famine, and he went to a strange country, and the king of that country is Abimelech. And Abimelech and Abram says to his Sarah's wife, don't tell them that you are my wife, because these people are very honorable. They will never commit adultery. So what will they do? They will make you a widow. And then you will be free. So say you are my sister. She says she is his sister. Oh, Abimelech asks, who is the lady? And Avram says, she says, I'm your brother and sister. He says, well, come and have tea with me. Come as one afternoon, have tea with me. You can't refuse. Next time he says, come and have dinner with me. The third time he says, come and have dinner with me, 9 o'clock this evening. He says, it's a bit late, don't we have dinner at 6 o'clock? He says, no, we make it 9 o'clock. She says, but you know, I've got to get back. He says, all right, there's plenty of room in the palace. At that moment, Hashem appears to him, he ranges the next night, Hashem appears to him in a dream, and Hashem tells him that he's under the sentence of death. And he is quite indignant with Hashem. Hashem, why? What have I done? Hashem says that you are about to commit an adulterous act with a woman. He said, but she told me that she was his sister. I haven't done anything wrong. My hands are clean. What is the answer? The answer is, my dear man, you ask Avraham Avinu, who is the lady? That's not your business. Your business is to ask, have you got a place where to lodge? You're a stranger in a strange country. Have you got a place where to eat? That's your business. It's not your business to ask who the lady is. That's not derech eretz. Gallantry, perhaps. But it's not derech eretz. For that you are under a sentence of death. And he immediately does tshuva and he's saved. What happened here in Shechem? Here comes one of them, takes Yaakov's daughter, seduces her, and it seems that there was more than seduction. First he forced her and the seduction came afterwards, as sometimes happens in these cases. After that, what do the rest of the people do? Do they condemn him for it? Or do they condone it? Not only do they condone it, they still support him. And when he wants to marry you, they say, wonderful idea, we'll help you. To such an extent, when they've all got to be circumcised, they say, fine. There's no condemnation. There's only condoning. No protest. This is the derech eretz. If a girl goes out, that's not the way you treat her. That is a lack of derech eretz. But still to condone it, so it means that there's no derech eretz there at all. The punishment for a complete lack of derech eretz is death. This is a very serious matter. That is why it all happened. But that is not the point that Yerush is making to Amatzio. All that he's telling him is, you don't stand a chance with me. And then he goes on to say in verse 10, he says, you know why you challenge me? You have just smitten the devil and your heart is high. You are proud, you are arrogant. He korvei, humble yourself. V'sheiv v'v'isecho, sit quietly at home. V'nomos is gore v'ro, why do you challenge evil? V'nofal to'a tovi yudi imoch, and you will fall and Yehuda together with you. Says Yerush, leave me alone and leave the northern kingdom alone. And then in verse 11 we are told, below Shomo Amatzio, and Amatzio didn't listen. It seems a little bit strange. All of a sudden he challenges him. What is it all about? Why should he challenge him? That we've got in book of Divrei Yomim, and I'm going to read to you in English the relative portion. Moreover, Amatzio has gathered Yehuda together and made them captains over thousands and captains over hundreds according to the houses of their fathers throughout all Yehuda and Binyamin. And he numbered them from 20 years old and upwards and found them 300,000 choice men able to go out to war that could handle spear and shield. So here we are told something about Amatzio which we are not told in the book of Kings. Namely, that he was not only a king, but he was a good general and a very good organizer. And he organizes an army of 300,000 chosen men. That's not enough. He wants a still greater army. And here is the fly in his ointment. He hired also 100,000 mighty men at arms out of Israel for 100 talents of silver. So now he has a paid army of 100,000 men together with his army of 300,000 men. But there came a man of God to him saying, a prophet comes to him, a Novi comes to him saying, O king, let not the army of Israel go with thee, for the Lord is not with Israel, with all these children of Ephraim. But if thou wilt go, and even if thou engage valiantly in the battle, God shall make thee fall before the enemy. If you don't listen to me, and you will take all the 100,000 men of Israel and go to battle, you will fall in battle, because Hashem is not with Israel at this moment. For God has power to help and to cast down. And Amashiel said to the man of God, but what shall we do for the 100 talents which I have given to the army of Israel? Pay them 100 talents? And the man of God answered, the Lord is able to give thee much more than this. Leave it. Don't worry about the money. If Hashem wants to give it to you, he will give it to you. Then Amashiel separated them. He agreed. If the prophet tells him that, he separated the 100,000 men, namely that army that was come to him out of Ephraim, from the northern kingdom, and bade them go home again, so that their anger burned strongly against Judah. When he told them to go home, they were very angry, and they returned home in great anger. The 100,000 men go back to Israel in great anger. After all, there was much to be gained in a successful war. There is all the booty and the spoil. And they go back in anger, and they be made to feel that they are not worthy of it. And Amatziah strengthened himself and led his people and went to the valley of Salt and smote 10,000 of the children of Seir, that is of Edom, and another 10,000 of the children of Judah carry alive captive, which is not mentioned in Kings, and brought them to the top of the rock, and they cast them down from the top of the rock, so that they all were broken to pieces. That is a separate chapter, and I might have an occasion to speak about that. And that was something that was unnecessary. But the soldiers of the army which Amatziah sent back, so that they should not go with him in battle, what did they do? They fell upon the cities of Judah, from Shomron as far as Beis Haron, and smote 3,000 of them and took much spoil. So what they did was, when Amatziah was out fighting the battle against Edom, they, these 100,000 soldiers from Israel, came down to the south and plundered the cities of Judah, and that is how they got their spoil and booty, which normally they would have got in the war. That is what they did. Now it came to pass, after Machiah was come from the slaughter of the Edomites, that he brought the gods of the children of Seir and set them up to be his gods, and prostrated himself before them, and burnt incense to them. Still does that. And now, so that the anger of the Lord burnt against Machiah, and he sent to him a prophet who said unto him, why hast thou sought after the gods of the people, who could not deliver their own people out of thy hand? And it came to pass, as he talked to him, that the king said to him, the old story, the king refuses to be admonished. Have we made thee of the king's counsel? Have I asked you to admonish me? Forbear, why shouldst thou be smitten? Then the prophet ceased and said, I know that God has determined to destroy thee, because thou hast done this, and hast not hearkened to my counsel. Because you have brought back gods from Edom, and now you serve those gods, and you don't listen to what I say, I know that Hashem is going to destroy you. Then Amatziah, king of Judah, took advice, and sent to Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, come, let us see one another in the face. And that is where we are now. Got it? There we are. This is where it supplements. And now, these two kings are going to fight. And as these two kings fight, Amatsyohu, the king of the south, loses to Yerosh, the king of the north, as the prophet told him he could have. That we carry on from next time. Now, please have your tea, but I've got still to go on and explain things to you, and I've got to have a full half hour. I have dealt with you.
No.
I've dealt both with how man is animal and how man is celestial. And we went through those two stages, two parts of man, very carefully, with the result that the dominant in man now is the animal. Whereas when man was created, the dominant in man was the heavenly, was the celestial.
Are they making a call?
No. Who is
this?
Warner
Parker.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry. I tried to make a call.
I'm sorry. Hello. Can I see
you there?
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Very sorry.
Now, the animal is by far the more dominant of the two. The Midrash was very kind to us and really gave us a key when he told us that that which governed the four animal qualities in the human being was prey or play, which was survival. So the driving force is survival. In the celestial man, in the heavenly man, the godlike man, the driving force is serendipity. He's got the image and the likeness of Hashem in it, and he strives to catch something that is godly for his life. No question that the overpowering force in our lives are these. And that is why it is the survival, the force that really drives us, is the force for survival. Occasionally you will see in a man who is completely materialistic, you will see something in him that is good. And you find that this is this little bit that is him, of seven to mix, this little bit in him, and this drives him to do that which is good. Today, I want to speak to you not about these driving forces, because we have covered that amply, at least for the time being. I want to speak to you today about Hishtapkut. Hishtapkut is fulfillment. Now, it is necessary for a human being to fulfill himself. He's got this drive for survival, and he's got to fulfill himself as far as that drive is concerned. Does he succeed or doesn't he succeed? He's got his business and he's got his profession and he works his fingers to the bone. And he puts his all into it. It is all for survival. All for survival. And then he does other things. And one wonders, what are the other things for? Sometimes he does some charity work. And we realize that there is something of the tzelem and the rusa. We find that there is some goodness in the person. There is some tzelem and the rusa. He wants to fulfill himself. Also, on this level, he's got it. Because fulfillment is one of his requirements. And if he has this drive, he's got to fulfill himself with that drive too. He's very little concerned with that. He's concerned with survival. But a little bit of it remains here. Now, I want you to realize what happens. A man realizes that another person is in trouble. I've had it 2 days ago. What was his trouble? This man is a very wealthy man. He's actually trouble with his son. He comes to a friend of his who is even more wealthy than he and says, I want you to give my son a job. He says, certainly, I'll give you such a job. What is it? Is he needed? He wants to help. Seven and this. Wants to help him. Of course. Got to fix him up immediately. This happened 2 days ago. Son is already working. Gave him a job in his cell. Only one thing went wrong. This even more wealthy man said to a friend of his, I was just waiting for an opportunity to have this. Now I've got it. The person to whom I'm doing the favor. Now I've got it.
Oh, you didn't do it for the right.
Now I've got it. So just what I wanted. Now, what's happening here? He does lose this, but this is overpowering. And even in the good that he does, this comes in. Even in the good that he does, it comes in. Does he fulfill himself as far as the tale of the goose is concerned?
I think so.
Now, a very interesting thing takes place. If we are speaking about the fulfillment of survival, the survival drive, is he fulfilling himself?
Yes.
The survival drive, I'm speaking generally about a person who's working, who's building up a business, and he's building up two businesses, and now he's got how many businesses, and he puts them all under one head, and he's losing track of it all himself already. And he's not stopping. How much does he need for survival? This isn't survival anymore. What is this? He's got everything he needs. He's got everything his children could possibly need for. He's made trusts. Do they do that thing in California? For children, for grandchildren in California, do they go as far as great-grandchildren, or do they stop at grandchildren? They go even further. He's made trusts already. Where's it all going to end? It's enough. Is that survival or it's not survival? Never ending. That's not survival. That is staring loose. Now I want to explain what happens here. We have got in the same as we have got this drive for survival, which is almost instinctive. So we've got a tselem ademus, a drive for tselem ademus, which is almost instinctive, but it is there, it is in the Jew. And I'm using the Jew because the Jew has got it in some respects even more than others have got it. And it works to his disadvantage too, not only to his advantage. I have from time to time spoken to you about the period between the two world wars and what the study of the Torah was during the two world wars. There is a book that has been written and it's called Or Elchanan, The Light of Elchanan. It's a book about Elchanan Wasserman, whom I had the privilege to know. and whom I had the privilege to listen to. I wasn't his disciple, but he used to come to where I was studying, and he used to give shiurim to us, 2-3 shiurim, and this used to happen several times during the year. And his son learned together with me, and we studied together. Rebbe Chonon Wasserman. If you read Rebbe Chonon Wasserman's life story, you will begin to understand. You can't fully understand it, because you can only fully understand it if you live that experience. That's the only way one can fully understand it. But then one begins to understand the poverty that there was. One of the great things about Rebbe Chonon Wasserman was that there was no difference between his own children and his disciples and his Talmidim. There was no difference. I have said that when I deal with somebody who studies together with me and whom I consider to be a disciple of mine, I deal with that person in exactly the same way as I deal with my own child. But that is only when I'm dealing with that person. My child I'm thinking of even when I'm not dealing with my child. There is a difference. And that has only come after many, many years of training and of discipline that I'm able to do that. But with Rebbe Chonon, it was every child who was a disciple, every Talmud of his provider was a proper Talmud. Sometimes one has a Talmud who's not a proper Talmud. But if one has that proper Talmud, and that Talmud has the allegiance and the loyalty, that Talmud to him was his child, and yet hundreds. It never happened that there was food in the home and there wasn't food for the Talmud. What used to happen was that there was no food in the home. There was no food for the Talmud. And his own children didn't have any food. And Rebbe Chonon Wasserman was a man that once he traveled from Shavu to Teruj, and there were some young men saw him on the train at Shavu. It's a distance in those days, the distance it used to take about 2.5 hours traveling. They put him on the train at Shavu. He bought a ticket, they put him on the train, and he comes to Teruj, and they take him off the train at Teruj. And he looks and he said, but haven't I seen you before? They said, yes, you saw him at Shavuot and on the station of Shavuot. Then he said, but how is it that I didn't see you on the train? They smiled. They said, you traveled third class. In California, they don't know what third class is, do they? In the trains in East in Europe, they have first class, second class, third class. He traveled first class clutch seats, second class upholded seats, third class benches, hard seats. They said there was a special excursion. There were trucks. So we got a special excursion. We traveled by truck. You traveled third class. That's why we didn't meet. So Rebbe Chonon said, how much did a third class ticket cost? They said, how much it cost? So he goes and stands aside and he takes out one purse, takes out the money, puts it back, takes out another purse and puts it in there. Repays the difference between third class and going truck, repays it. He had no right to travel third class when he could have traveled in a truck. He was traveling for the yeshiva. So that is Rebbe Chonon Wasserman. Such absolute poverty. Now, today, that doesn't exist. It doesn't exist because Hashem knows that if that is what a person who studies Torah will have to endure, you think he's going to do it? He can go to college, he can go to university. Look at the things he can do. What does he have to endure that for? So now he studies Torah and he goes to yeshiva And they have swimming pools, and they have tennis courts, and they have playing fields. And they have good food, and they have holidays. Quite a different world. In that period, and it's not a long time ago, in that period, I didn't really suffer when I was studying very little. Two meals a day I had. I didn't go home once for 10 years. I was away for 10 years. Couldn't afford to go home. During the 10 years, I had one holiday. And I was very thankful for that. And I had it good. But the suffering that there was, how can one endure that? For that one needs Mesilus Nefesh. Now Mesilus Nefesh is a dedication to the point of death. That rather than have a life without Torah, I'd rather die. So this is dedication to the point of death. Mesilus Nefesh. Don't know what it is today. That is the Mesilus Nefesh that we have. Now, look what happens. In towards the end of last century, there started the movement, the communist movement in Europe. Who were those who were most active in Russia in the communist movement?
Jews.
Young Jews and Jewesses. They got together towards the end of the 1880s and they made the Bund. They made an organization. And in this organization they decided that they would take minutes in Russian because they didn't want Jews known as Jews and all that. I suppose they knew as much Russian as I know Japanese, which is very little. But they struggled, it had to be in Russian. And this was against the government, of course. They went all out, didn't mind, to such an extent that in, I think it was in 1904, the Russian government, the Tsarist government, decided to clamp down once and for all. So they went throughout Russia, towns and villages, but especially the villages, and they got the communists together, put them to the wall. Are you a communist or not? If you said yes, they shot. If you said no, they let you go. Because they realized if a person didn't have the courage to say yes when he was a communist, they didn't have to worry about him. Who were the ones who said yes and were shot? Jews. Who were the ones who said no and were let go, were sent free? The Russians. Then they realized what was happening. Then they realized, and they made already Jewish parties within all this and worked together as Jews. Then they realized. Do you realize the amount of Mesilus Nefesh that went into it? The Gentiles didn't have. Who were the ones who helped the blacks most in America?
The Jews.
But to the point of Mesilus Nefesh,
yes.
Who are the ones who did it? In South Africa, I've got a very close friend of mine who is a professor of pediatrics, and he and his wife, who is an anesthetist, they call it something else here, practiced in a black hospital. Their whole lives they gave to the blacks. One day he was in Johannesburg, he was going to fetch his car and he had to go through a lane. And there were some blacks who were there and very innocently, he loves blacks. Very innocently he goes past them and in no time they had surrounded him. And they were dancing around him in a lane off a main thoroughfare. They were dancing around him very loudly and closing in on him and then threw him to the ground and started jumping on him. And his cries couldn't be heard until the man who was expecting him to come and fetch his car came out. He usually comes that time, came out and saw this and just wanted to know what was going on there. Why were they dancing? And he had a big spanner in his hand, and when they saw him coming, they quickly dispersed. The rich. And then they quickly dispersed, and he managed to get into a hospital for almost a year. His kidneys were very badly damaged. For almost a year, he was on the point of death, and eventually he recovered. He had Mysterious Nefesh. From where did he have that Mysterious Nefesh? That is the Mysterious Nefesh that a Jew has. Hashem has given. For the Torah, one needs a tremendous amount of Mysterious Nefesh. So what does he do? He's got to fulfill himself in Salem and Demus. And this Mysterious Nefesh for a great cause is Salem and Demus. So what does he do? He transfers it to something is grateful way. He transfers it. If you ask those people who did so much for the blacks in America, why did you do it? I have asked them. And the answer is, look what this was done to us. We've got to help them. Because they can do the same thing to us also. And who were the first ones who turned on the Jews? Those blacks were the first ones who turned on the Jews. But we've got to do it because they can do it to us also. So it's self-protection, it's survival. That is the reason it is done. But what is done is that a godly faculty is taken in order to implement this, and there is a transference that takes place. And so the person thinks that he's satisfying himself and fulfilling himself also in Salem and the Jews. I want to give you one other example. The example of the man that I've given you, he builds up an empire, money and property. He can't live in all those homes. The income is much more than he can possibly use up. And then he goes in for art treasures. And then he goes in for stamps. What doesn't he only go in for? And he doesn't end. And the Torah says, Oved kesef lo yisba kesef. A person who loves money, money will never satisfy. We'll never have enough of it. So if it is a question of survival, surely when that is achieved, surely one stops. Why doesn't one stop? One doesn't stop for a very simple reason. When one comes to these qualities, which are heavenly qualities in the human being, it's ruchnius, it's spiritual. If it's spiritual, it's infinite. It cannot be, it's not defined. It's not confined. It's infinite. There is no end to it. To Torah, is there any end? To the study of Torah, is there any end? To goodness, is there any end? There is no end to any of these things. To anything that is spiritual, there is no end. And he's got this ingrained in him that he's dealing with infinity. So what does he do? He transfers it. Can never have enough of it. A person, if he's in Torah, he can never have enough of it. Never ends. There's never enough. So he transfers this so that he can fulfill himself also on the level of Tzelem Demus. And that is a mistake that we all make. We transfer godly faculties that we have and we put them to work in these animal faculties that we have. And we implement them for the sake of survival, thinking that we are fulfilling ourselves, either spiritually also. And isn't really happening. And the frustration comes when the man realizes that he's not fulfilling himself spiritually. I don't know whether I've ever mentioned it to you. One of the happiest days in my life was when my son, who is your rabbi today, was very difficult. It was very difficult to get oneself going. So he went in, my brother took him into his business. And my brother came to me after he had been with me almost a year. And he said, this is what our son has earned last month, and this is what he has earned this month. Just see what he's achieved in a year. He said, the first 3 months he didn't earn a thing. This is what he's achieved in a year. I was one of the best paid rabbis in South Africa. He was earning more than I was. Within a week, my son came to me and he said, I have a chance of going to this shul and working at this shul with young people. And I said to him, you know what it means going to that shul? You're going to have a rabbi over you, which is not at all bad. You're going to have a council over you. You're going to have an executive over you. You're going to have a president over you. And the rabbi is under the council, and the council is under the executive, and the executive is under the president, and the president is under the president's wife. And you will have to take all that. Do you know what it means? And he said to me, Dad, do you know what it means when you've sold radio sets and you come back at night and that is all you've got to show for the day? I'm unfulfilled. It was one of the happiest moments in my life. It's all I wanted to hear. All I wanted to hear. It wasn't any confusion. He wasn't out to earn more and more, and it's endless. And there is a transference of the godly to the earthly. Mm-hmm. And thinking that he's fulfilling himself there too. The frustration came exactly at the right time. Doesn't work. And if one doesn't fulfill oneself in both areas, there is frustration. And one knows it. So unconsciously, there is this transference that takes place. Now, I've got to tell you that it works in the reverse too, but this is even worse. This is even worse. You find the person who is devoting himself to this. And then you say, but I'm not earning enough. I've got to have more. And he builds a yeshiva. And then he builds the yeshiva into an empire. And he wants still more and still more. And then he starts dismissing this person, dismissing this person. Ask him why. Survive. So what is he doing? He is using this in order to get away. And he uses this to get away with this. But he's transferring the survival to this area. Where it should be an area where it's clean, he's transferring this. He does a chesed. But I'll get up. I'll help him. But I'll get very much more than I'm giving. So he's doing a chesed. He's doing a chesed. And behind it all, there is this. He's transferring this to his head. And that is where the frustration comes in. That's where the frustration comes in. If the person is a delicate soul, he possesses a delicate soul, what then happens is, he's trying to, by the way, before I come to that, some people try to drown this instinct by art, by music. Very good on its own. Have you ever heard a person say, my religion is music? My religion is music. What he does is he's drowning. Of course music is something that's not material. Of course art is something that isn't material. So he tries to drown it in that, and if he can't drown it in music and in art, and he can't drown it in culture, he drowns it in enjoyment. Gets pleasure. Gets thrills. If he is a sensitive soul, there comes about a discovery. And realize that there is a disparity in his fulfillment. Fulfilling himself here and not fulfilling himself there. And when there is this disparity, there is a frustration, then there is desperation. Are you pardon? Yes. Yes.
Okay,
ask it
now?
Yes,
I wondered if this might be the reason for some of the hostility toward people who are involved with the people who are making that distortion feel frustrated but can identify.
Very much so. Very much so. Oh. Very much so. Rabbi Akiva said when he was in Amoritz, when he didn't have any carrier, he said, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of a Talmud Chacham. Give me a Talmud Chacham," said Rabbi Akiva, "and I will sink my teeth into him like an hyena." And his Talmud said, "You mean like a dog?" Said, "No, a dog bites and lets go. And hyena bites and crushes the bones." So I understand it very well. You're absolutely right. That's what he did. And then there comes desperation. What's the difference between frustration and desperation? Person who's frustrated goes to a psychologist, a person who's desperate goes to a psychiatrist. Only chance he's got to help. Then there's desperation. You had it in Stefan Zweig. Had it in Stefan Zweig. This person, he literature, art, music, culture was his world to the exclusion of anything else. He didn't want to be known as a Jew. He wouldn't even admit to himself that he was a Jew. And Hitler Germany came along, and he was a Jew. And he goes to Brazil and commits suicide. He had no business to commit suicide. Completely unfulfilled. There was a transference of values, and he was desperate. Couldn't think of self. That is what happens. The worst is when I tell you the case that I had a young Rosh Hashiva. Fortunately, he's out now. A young Rosh Hashiva took in another person to help him. In fact, the other person did a tremendous amount for him. And then, when he established his kingdom, he threw him out. And the way he threw him, and how he pursued him, and there was an assassination of his character that went right through the country. And he got people to give evidence of them. Evidence was lies. And I asked him, he said, I said, how can you do a thing like that? He laughed and he says, it's survival. Those were his words. So what does he do? It's all survival. But this is a transference to the world of survival in order to fulfill himself spiritually where there is the whole question of survival. And it's false. It's artificial. It's false. It's an illusion. That's the reason. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.